Welcome to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from May 3rd, 2001.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening and or good morning across this great land of ours from the island of Guam, the Rock, way out across the dateline, way out there, eastward to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, south into South America, north to the pole, and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm Art Bell. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to KEWS-FM in Riverside, California. Riverside, how about that? 99.3 on the dial, on the FM dial. Welcome to the program. Glad to have you along. Been through Riverside many, many, many times. Well, it's going to be an interesting night tonight, because we're all going to go to hell. At least those of us who stick around for the next hour. A man who was an atheist, a real atheist, I guess. He's now a reverend, but he was an atheist. Had a near-death experience and went to hell. And he's got an extensive description for you of what hell is like. I've never heard anybody tell me that before. Maybe a little glimpse with Sarah of what might be, but this will be a trip all the way to the real place. That's coming up next hour. This hour, quite a few things for you, actually. The whole thing over Tito is getting a little ridiculous. From MSNBC, let me read you a little of this, May 3rd. The U.S.-Russian rhetorical duel over space tourist Denis Tito's multi-million-dollar ride to the International Space Station has flared again. NASA's chief says the trip has put, quote, incredible stress, end quote, on the agency, and that the Russians will be getting a babysitting bill. But Russia said Tito's presence hasn't influenced space station operations at all, and a top Russian space executive said Golden's comments demonstrated incompetence. As a matter of fact, NASA officials, as you well know, have grumbled for weeks about Tito's trip to the space station aboard a Soyuz spacecraft. In March, the agency barred the space engineer turned financier from training sessions at the Johnson Space Center, sparking a one-day walkout by his two Russian shipmates. NASA and the other station partners didn't give Tito's flight their original go-ahead until 4 days before launch last Saturday. And on the day before the mission, NASA tried to get the Russians to delay liftoff due to computer problems on the International Space Station. During testimony before the House Subcommittee on Space and Aeronautics on Wednesday, NASA Administrator Dan Golden indicated that the frictions haven't been smoothed over. Quote, "The current situation has put an incredible stress on the men and women of NASA," Golden said. "They're dedicated to safety, and Mr. Tito does not realize the efforts of thousands of people in the U.S. and Russia that are working to protect his safety and the safety of everyone else, taking extraordinary means." After Tito's return to Earth, NASA will seek reimbursement from the Russians for any costs caused by construction delays or lost working hours on the station. You know, this is just absolutely, it's getting absolutely ridiculous. This is an American up there, an American with a past with NASA, the early days of NASA. What the hell are we doing? I mean, really, what are we doing? Remember I told you I was going to, on somebody's suggestion, Richard's or somebody's, that I would try and get hold of Tito and see if we could do an interview. And I knew it was going to be a low probability thing. And sure enough, it has been. We contacted Tito's representative first, and he said, "You'll have to talk to NASA." So we talked to NASA, and NASA said, "You're going to have to call the Russians." And they gave us the number in Russia, and we'll follow up with that, you know, but what's going on here? This man goes a long way back with NASA himself. He is an American. we have the biggest monetary investment in the International Space Station as Americans. We do. So what the hell's wrong with an American going up to the space station? I don't get it. I just don't get it. And to me, it's an embarrassment that in a request to try and talk to an American on the International Space Station, NASA just says you're going to have to talk to the Russians. I mean, what kind of attitude is that, really? What an embarrassment for NASA, as far as, I mean, what a real embarrassment for NASA, in my opinion. Sure, Grumbly's up there, I guess. But he's there. I mean, we put an American school teacher up there, remember, or we tried. Blew up. But it's not as though occasionally a civilian shouldn't be allowed on the space station. It's a lot of taxpayer money up there. What's wrong with having a civilian up there? I mean, particularly if he pays his own way. And he has to go to our prior enemies, the Russians, to buy his way up there. And then after that, it's nothing but trouble. And an American Broadcasting Network wants to talk to an American. And so the American agency, NASA, says, no, you'll have to talk to the Russians. I think that's embarrassing for us. Just downright embarrassing. Several people suggested, well, I could do it by ham radio. And that's absolutely correct. I could do it by ham radio. But it would be not legal. You cannot use ham radio for a commercial purpose. And so, yeah, it was a good idea, except the law doesn't allow it. I'm kind of angry with NASA. I think that's a really terrible attitude to take, and I don't know why they're taking it. As they pointed out in the article, they actually tried to delay the launch. Saying it was computers, you know, there's something wrong with this. What is wrong with the whole picture, huh? An American has to go to our former enemies to buy his way up to a space place that we own more of than anybody else. I mean, if you really want to break it down that way. I think that sucks. And then an American broadcasting company, granted NASA may not, I may not have great favor at NASA, I understand that. But you would think they'd want to think really hard, wouldn't you? Before they say, oh no, you'll have to go talk to the Russians. I mean, we can't allow you to talk to an American over American communications equipment. Oh, come on, that just really sucks. There's something else going on here that has to do with I don't know what. Ego, security, something they're not telling us. Or arrogance. Maybe arrogance, huh? Are we so arrogant that we can't imagine somebody with Mr. Tito's background being in our precious space station? Only thoroughly and carefully trained NASA astronauts can do it? Hogwash. Old guys can go to the... Look at John Glenn. He went to the space station. Why not? Why not have a little democracy in space? What the hell's wrong with NASA? Sure is getting to me. And then here's something else getting to me, too. As you know, China announced that because of the airplane incident, they were going to have a week of let's hack American government sites. And I think last night I said, or was it the night before, recently, that all things considered, if there's going to be a war, which they're the ones who, they've declared it, that I think that they've made a very bad decision, because I know our hackers. We have really good hackers in America. And as far as I'm concerned, screw them. I got this today from somebody, Mr. Bell. I was disappointed to hear the comments you made on the air The morning of May 3rd, well, there you go, May 3rd, you were discussing computer attacks made by Chinese hackers on American websites. You warned the Chinese that if they wanted to start a war, that American hackers are much better than Chinese hackers, and then you advised the Chinese to go right ahead and hack away. Well, they, of course, they're doing that. I just added that. The connotation was that American hackers would do much worse to the Chinese. First of all, I was very disappointed in the intolerant war-mongering attitude you displayed. Must you step right up to assume the typical American king of the world posture that is despised around the world? You need to step down from your ivory tower for a few moments and consider how this superior, holier-than-thou position makes you look to others. I'm sure you would not like to see the ArtBell.com site hacked into. I'll bet other website operators in the U.S. feel the same way. Well, look, first of all, this is from Thane in London, Canada. Well, Thane, I think you've got it all wrong, buddy. We didn't start it, but in American fashion, I was simply suggesting we can finish it. As far as hackers into our side, I've had plenty of hackers, some of the best hackers in the U.S. on the air. I think they're not very likely to hack away at my site, although it's hacked at all the time. That's the nature of big sites on the Internet. They get hacked. Or, let me put it this way, it's a, they're certainly attempted to be hacked. So it's something we put up with all the time. But we're talking about government sites here, for the most part. Far as I know, U.S. government sites being hacked. And civilian sites, I guess, by the Chinese. And so I say again, if they want to hack us, then fine. Let's hack the hell out of them. Let's take their sites down the best way we can. And we've got some really good people at it. I know. I've talked to them. So from my perspective, screw the Chinese. They began the war. I'm of the view that, you know, leave somebody else alone and leave them alone and let us all coexist and do our own thing and go our own way. But when somebody comes and kicks you in the shins, I'm all for kicking back. And I think we can kick back better. Yeah, there may be more Chinese, but trust me when I tell you our hackers are the most sophisticated hackers in the world. And I say, go get them. To hell with them. They started hacking us several days ago. Let's get them. Simple as that. They want a hacking war, they'll get a hacking war. So for whoever this is, Thane in London, Canada, you're just going to have to go on and be disappointed, I'm afraid. We'll be right back. Stay right where you are.
Now we take you back to the night of May 3rd, 2001, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Well, here's another story from the BBC on a mad deer disease in Colorado. The disease, which began in the wild now, is spreading to the farms. So the elk at Steve Wolcott's farm are at risk. It may be a problem when infected carcasses are brought back across the country, he said. I think that we have to be concerned about this material being able to infect other wild deer populations in other parts of the country. The disease is identical to BSE in the way it attacks the brain and nervous system of the deer. It cannot be detected until shortly before death. And now, the threat to humans. There is an additional cause for concern, the article goes on. Laboratory tests have shown that humans could contract this illness in the same way as BSE, although we have no cases thus far. From the Colorado a health department's point of view. At this point, the answers to these questions are unknown because of the BSE experience. It is theoretically possible, and based on that, there are some precautions that hunters may want to take. A farm in the mountains of Nevada may hold the key to the puzzle of mad deer disease. Gee, here in Nevada, great. A farm's owner, a cowboy, Jim Kopecki, I believe it is, died suddenly from CJD, an illness very similar to both BSE and mad deer variant. Brenda, Jim's widow, admits that he loved to hunt, and it is possible he may have died from eating infected deer meat. As she said, I couldn't comprehend that a cowboy in the middle of farming Nevada could get such a horrendous disease, she said. So I dragged the poor man to many other doctors looking for something that made just any sense at all. He was the third deer hunter to die in the last 2 years from CJD. So far, the evidence suggests it is simply a coincidence. Do you all believe it is a coincidence? Interesting story. 60 pregnant cows with human genes. Do you remember that experiment? Putting human genes into cows? Well, now the story is they may be slaughtered after a high court ruling has thrown one of the country's best-known genetic experiments into doubt. Scientists at Hamilton's Ruraka Research Center have inserted a synthetic basic human protein into cattle fetuses in an experiment to improve the treatment of multiple sclerosis, an incurable neurological condition affecting coordination. The experiment was approved by the Environmental Risk Management Authority. The Environmental Risk Management Authority. So apparently, these are the people that decide what sort of genetic experiments we're going to be allowed to do and or not allowed to do. Anyway, they approved this one. And now it may end in disaster for the animals. They're saying that it'd be more humane to kill a pregnant cow now than wait until it gave birth and then kill the mother and the baby. Maybe it wasn't such a good idea to do this experiment in the first place. Maybe a number of the genetic experiments that we are considering right now, not such a smart idea. I mean, as I interview people here on the air, and you know I have interviewed people in these areas recently, I think that we're on a very, very, very slippery slope. With just about all of the genetic manipulation that we're beginning to engage in, from the level of plants to animals to humans. I know it's well-intentioned, at least I pray so, and I imagine so, that it is well-intentioned, trying to learn something about some disease. But if the risk, if the other side of the equation is that some gene is going to, as we heard last night, jump from some newly created strain of wheat that keeps the bugs away, and it's going to jump to an animal, and then ultimately to a human, then we're going to eventually have some kind of disaster. And so I would hope that before approving the next experiment, and I'm anything but anti-science, whoever these risk assessment people are, they will assess more carefully and consider what we're doing. And I'm not against advancing science. I just don't want to end up with a moral dilemma. I don't want to end up with monsters. And I certainly don't want some worldwide disaster occurring because some scientist goes, oops, oops, drop the vial. Isn't that the whole way the Captain Trips thing began? Good morning. We'll take a break and then we'll do open lines at the top of the next hour. We're all going to take a trip to hell, a real trip to hell. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from May 3rd, 2001. Listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from May 3rd, 2001.
Good morning, everybody, and I've got something very interesting for you this morning. I try to always have that, but if you'll go to my website, in the What's News section of my website, the first item is the disclosure conference notice about what Stephen Greer is going to be doing, Dr. Greer, and he'll be here tomorrow night to give you kind of a preview of an incredibly important event in Washington. So that's tomorrow night. But the second item down, I think you should take a look at. It says, weird whirlpool story on links page. Click on that and go down to the second set of links and click on weird whirlpool. And this really is pretty bizarre stuff, and I'd love to have your opinion of what we're seeing here. A strange phenomena spinning off the coast of San Diego. Some say it comes from out of this world. And there's a picture of it there. It can be best described as a giant whirlpool caught on videotape off Black's Beach. A camera flying in a biplane shot the footage with his home video camera. And it is extraordinary, to say the least. And I guess you can get the actual video that he shot on the site. Oceanographers say they've never seen anything like it, but at least one expert says an unidentified underwater object might have caused the weird whirlpool. And then they go on to talk about flying saucers, UFOs, strange lights, and so forth and so on, that people have seen in the area. But you've really got to see this. There's nothing on this earth short of a waterspout that could do this. And obviously, there is no weather anywhere close that would indicate there's a water sprout going on. So we've got this swirling going on in the water, this unaccountable swirling. And I'm wondering about all kinds of things. I'm wondering about an energy that could cause this. I'm wondering about the power that makes crop circles, which we found on dirt and in dust and all kinds of things, and if there could be some relationship to what we're seeing here. A big whirlpool in the ocean for no apparent scientific discernible reason. Now, that bears some study, and I'd suggest you go read the article. Take a look at the video. It's, again, under What's New, and then it will take you to our links page, and you can go from there. But there's lots to wonder about with regard to this whirlpool. What would do that to the ocean? I mean, completely defeating the wave action, and it looks like a black hole in the water. Damnedest thing you ever saw. What would cause that? So, I've got a link up there. Keith got that up there a little earlier today, but that's really got me thinking.
Now, we take you back to the night of May 3rd, 2001, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
First time caller line, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
This is Sean, Western New York.
Yes, Sean.
A few brief things about your little story there on NASA. I haven't even hit 30 yet, and I thought about maybe dabbling in a little bit of politics, okay?
All right.
And of course, the delusions of grandeur and the daydreaming brought me up. It's like, wow, what if I could actually sit into a position that would help me push for more space exploration, you know, thinking more money for NASA.
Sure.
And then you come on the air tonight, and I thought, boy, if this is really how it is, you know, what would be the point?
Well, I mean, isn't it kind of stupid, the whole thing? This is an American who's up there, and to me, maybe there's something I really don't know, but we're acting like asses.
And the space station there. You know, I said to myself when I heard they were going to put it up and do it in a joint effort, thinking, now this is the way the world should be, and here we go,
yeah.
Politics,
yeah.
And,
yeah.
And money and everything.
Exactly.
I gotta screw it up. So that's about it.
Oh, that'll do. Thank you very much. I could not agree with you more. I mean, it's really we're acting like asses. Now, maybe we're not properly telling our side of the story. Maybe there's some side of the story that I just haven't heard. I don't know. But the whole attitude about this is all wrong. All wrong. Tito, as I said, he's not exactly just a civilian with money. He had a lot of training with NASA. He goes way back with NASA. And he had to go to our former enemy, and that galls me, to buy his way up to a place where we are. And then once there... NASA can't see its way to let us use a channel of communication to communicate with him. They've got to send us to Russia to do that. I think it's embarrassing for us. Really embarrassing. That's what we got told by NASA earlier. They gave us the phone number to the Russians. Doesn't that kind of stink? I mean, well. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Mr. Bell?
Yes, hi.
Oh, hey, hello. This is I'm Caleb, and I'm calling from Birmingham WERC 960.
Yes, sir.
I had a couple of ideas that may interest you. One is about the location of the actual hell, and I'm a Christian myself, and I heard this from a very reliable source, and I think he's a doctor. Anyway, you know about the black holes in space, right?
Sure.
All right. Well, you know how like they can suck up suns, you know, and
they can eat suns. They can absorb light, bend light toward them. A lot of things.
Yes, sir. And see, the suns inside, there's no way that the heat can escape, so it grows hotter and hotter in there, and so that's millions and billions of.
So you're thinking hell's in a black hole, maybe?
Well, yeah, because the Bible does say that there'll be eternal darkness. And that it'll be, like, some, I can't remember the number, but some number of times hotter than the sun, than our, like the sun, our sun, and that is a very interesting idea, I think. And I also had another interesting idea a while ago when I was listening to you on while I was calling you. Whenever you mentioned the thing about Tito in space and how the computers, like they had a computer problem before we went up to space and they had to delay it. They asked them to delay it, you know?
Yes, and the Russians said no one launched.
Well, then you mentioned the 1986 explosion of the the teacher was on board.
The Challenger, yes.
Yeah, I was only two when that happened, but a few years ago I found, you know, I learned a little bit about it. I don't know too much about it, but what this is, I'm not trying to be paranoid or anything here, but what do you think the possibilities of that maybe someone at NASA or some heads of NASA maybe have staged that explosion because of a civilian?
I don't buy into that.
Yeah, but that was just a thought that came to mind. I mean, you know, you can't.
Okay, let me put it to you out straight. NASA's doing some stuff that's pretty screwed up, but they're not murderers. I know there are people that have said such things, but I'm not one of them. No, not a chance, not in my mind. However, this attitude that they have right now is just ridiculous. It's embarrassing for the United States in every way, every step of the way here. It's embarrassing. To me, it's embarrassing that one of our own has to go to a former enemy, buy his way up there, then essentially get snubbed up there with Golden making all kinds of catty remarks. And then we're a pretty damn big broadcasting concern, I can tell you. And so we began to make some inquiries today, and we talked to Tito's rep, who said, no, you'll have to talk to NASA. Okay, fair enough. So we talked to NASA, and they give us the phone number of a Russian guy. Now, we might be able to do it that way, although I'm hearing rumors now that there may be something in his contract saying he can't do anything commercial from the space station. Now, I don't know what that means. Does that mean he can't endorse Wheaties or something? Or does that mean that he can't do an interview with a broadcast concern? I don't know. So maybe contractually he can't do it. Who knows? But if we did ever pull it off, we would have to, it would be almost like an email conversation. I mean, you'd have to have a landline from here to Russia, probably satellite, actually, with all the lag time. And then, of course, up to space again, and the question arrives, and they answer, and then it goes back down again, back up to another satellite, back down to the U.S., and we get the answer. It almost, there'd be such a delay having to go through Russia. It would be kind of annoying, but I would go ahead and, of course, take the opportunity and do it anyway. But it could be so much easier if our own organization, supported by taxpayers, NASA, would allow it to occur. But not to Tito. Only to approved astronauts. Not to Tito, an American citizen who's up there. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi. Oh, push the button. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hello, this is Mark in Newport, Oregon.
Hello, Mark.
And I bounced around on about five or six channels here on the coast trying to keep up with your show. I was watching News World International about an hour and a half ago, and there was a report on a company called, I think, Nexius out of New York, and they were saying that they've already cloned goats with spiders.
Yeah, you know, I read that on the internet earlier that they were about to. Why would they want to clone a goat and a spider?
The milk has the spider silk properties, and they're looking at making bulletproof vests. They say it's meteor proof for spacecraft.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, it was a report, and they were showing the goats. They didn't actually show them like milking them and making the spider web, but they were showing the DNA, and they were saying that here, this part's the spider contribution.
Spider.
Glad you're back, man.
I appreciate your call, sir. Thank you.
Good night.
We're headed down some strange places with all of this. You've got to admit, that's a pretty strange combination. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hi.
Yes.
Turn your radio off, please.
Yes. Okay. On the 503 here on Washington, and just wanted to ask you if you would ask your guest tonight. Sometimes Major Gaines had to had talked at one time about the differences when he was talking about Lucifer and Satan and about the fact of the crystalline colors. You might want to ask your guests about the fact that if he happened to be in the same place at the same time, or he's actually here on Earth doing his thing.
Well, let's see what he has to say. I'd rather not prejudice his answer in any way. I'd just soon hear his story in detail. I've never heard anybody really say, other than Sarah, who got pretty close or got a glimpse, but I've never heard anybody else talk about hell. This is going to be a first.
My question to you also, too, is are you going to have Kathleen Keaton on again?
Oh, no doubt. I'm sure we will, yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the particular person, and I know you've asked not to say it, and I won't, but the particular person is becoming very active. And,
oh, yeah, that person she has named as the Antichrist.
Yes, that's correct.
Yes.
But you had asked not to
use that name,
and I won't.
I still would rather not, yes.
Right, and out of respect for that, I won't. But,
thank you. It's not hard to find. Look, people want to find
right,
it. They go on the
right,
Internet.
Exactly.
They'll figure it out.
But it's very interesting that not only is it just this particular person that you had talked to before, but now there's actual ambassadors that are talking about him, too.
Oh, I'm well aware. Thank you very much that this person is very real. And the claims made by this person. Oh, yes, I'm very aware of it. And yes, of course, we'll have Kathleen on again. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art. This is Roger. Listen to you via the Internet.
Yes, sir.
I don't know if it was when you were sick, but are you going to have the head of the FCC on?
That's Raleigh Hollingsworth. And, yeah, we are going to have him on. He simply begged off for a period of time so that he could kind of get the lay of the land with the new commissioner coming in.
Okay.
So you want to, you know, you want to understand what policy is before you try and go on the radio and talk about what it is.
Can't implement what you don't know.
Yeah, that's right. So I thought his decision was wise, and he said he would come on.
Okay. Do you have another time frame? Or?
No, not yet. I'll write to him soon. We'll find out.
Okay.
All right.
Have a good show.
Thank you. East of the Rockies, you're on the air.
On me?
Yes, on you.
On me?
Turn your radio off, please, dear.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
On May 1st, you had someone by the name of Alan. I didn't get the last name.
Mesher? Yes.
And I didn't get all his number. I got 3,100, but I didn't get the first two numbers.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. I don't have that info here. Your best shot is the website. It'll still have all the information on it.
And as far as I heard somebody speaking about the Challenger.
Yes.
There was a young man who was doing research on the Challenger before it went up. Mm. And he told all the powers that be that not to send up the Challenger because the rings could not withstand the cold temperature.
Oh, I know. There was a great big investigation about the whole thing. I'm very, very well aware of it. Obviously, a poor decision, and there were a lot of meetings about that at NASA. And, you know, it's funny. I've watched a lot of launches since, and a lot of them have scared me because if you remember the video of the Challenger and you remember the flames that were licking around, do you remember that? I've seen that on subsequent flights, and I've gone, oh, man. But I guess it's okay, and, you know, people see things, but it very much looked like the same sort of flame to me that was certainly the problem, and they showed in great detail in the Challenger footage just prior to the explosion. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes. Hi, Art.
Hi.
This is Reba in Colville.
Hi there.
Well, since you're talking about the Challenger, I thought I'd add something here. Dick Scobee, when he was very young, taught me how to ride a bike.
No kidding.
Yes. When I was living up in Martin, and his grandfather was on the section crew for the railroad.
Well, riding bikes is the first time is a very serious matter indeed.
Oh, it was.
I remember myself. So.
Now, I have a question.
Yes.
How's it going with getting Shirley MacLaine on?
Well, I don't know. I actually haven't tried yet.
Oh, okay.
But I'm sure we'll get her on. I mean, I think she was on not too long before I left.
Yes, she was.
So we'll get her on again.
and be sure to ask her about her saving seeds, please.
Saving seeds. All right.
Yes, thank you.
You bet. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, hi. My name's Al, truck driver, a new listener, and a new caller, first time caller. Wanted to ask you a question about the chemtrails. Never caught the tail end about it, and I've been noticing them also myself.
Well, what kind of question would you ask?
Well, I barely got turned on to your show, about a couple of months maybe, and the I never caught the tail end of the chemtrails other than I started looking out for them. I live up in Hesperia by Victorville. I'm a truck driver. I travel all around. And I did notice them. In Hesperia, we have clean, nice air up there. And just like your callers mentioned that by the afternoon, it's real gloomy out there and horrible looking.
Gloomy and hazy, right. After,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and then one time I was up in Hayward, California, and I was up there for about 5 hours, and I noticed it was a clean sky in the morning, and then by the mid-afternoon, I saw all the chemtrails up there, and then it started getting really ugly looking, and as I drove away, I'm coming down the 5, and I stopped and I looked, and you could just see overhead this horrible gloom over the skies. Have you found out what's going on yet?
No. Absolutely not. The latest theory, I think the most accepted present theory, is that there's weather control, that they're trying to do something to correct what they see as a deteriorating situation with the weather.
I see. Now, three things I did notice. One time I was coming back from San Diego and going to out there by Temecula, and it was at night, and I started noticing these chemtrails, and it was a clear night. Now, the three occasions. The next in Hayward, I noticed that the following day there was rain there.
Sir, we're coming to the end of the show here.
Okay.
Anyway, the first hour of the show, so I've got to scoot.
Okay, all right. Well, anyways, I did notice rain after the following day out of those three occurrences. I just wanted to let you know that.
Okay, thank you very much.
It was a great show. Thank you.
Take care, my friend. We're going to hell next.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from May 3rd, 2001.
Yeah, 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 I'm ready. Oh, 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 I'm ready. And I'm really gonna write tonight. I think she died for Beethoven. She looked away from Jenny last night.
Oh, yeah, military thing.
Radio Networks presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired May 3rd, 2001.
The Reverend Howard Storm is up and coming. He's back in Kentucky. He's Reverend for the Zion United Church of Christ. I will tell you more about him in a moment, but basically, he went to hell. He was an atheist, and he went to hell, and you just don't get to hear very many descriptions of what hell is like, ever. I don't think we ever have. Not really. Well, He says he's got one.
Now we take you back to the night of May 3rd, 2001, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Well, in a way, I've been waiting to do this interview for a long time, maybe all my life. I've never had anybody describe hell to me, and that's what Reverend Storm says he can do. Again, he is a reverend for the Zion United Church of Christ in Norwood, Ohio. He has a BFA from San Francisco Art Institute in 1969, an MA from the University of California at Berkeley in 1970, MFA, University of California, Berkeley, 72, MDIV, United Theological Seminary, 1992. So that was the MFA in 72 and the Theological Seminary in 92. Ordination, June 14th of 92, United Church of Christ. Was employed by the Northern Kentucky University as a professor of art, 1972 to 92. So has a long career. Coordinator or chairperson of art department for 7.5 years. And then the Zion United Church of Christ pastoring from 1992 to present. He's made all kinds of television appearances and radio, I would presume. He was an art professor and an atheist. And welcome, Reverend.
Thank you.
Good to have you on the air with us. I guess I would just have you tell your story. You were an atheist in the purest sense of the word at one time?
Yeah, I probably around 16 or 17 years old gave up on religion, completely gave up on it when I went to college.
Any reason why?
It seemed pointless that, you know, they talked about being good all the time and...
You couldn't be good all the time.
Well,
none of us
can. That was, you know, well, actually, that was a kind of a problem. You know, when you're 16 and raging hormones and stuff, I was my interests were a lot different than sitting in church singing hymns.
I understand.
Not boring,
right? You know, right.
And silly. And then I just, as I went to college and stuff, came to realize at the time, from that point of view, that I was being deceived. That there was no afterlife, there was no heaven or hell, there was no God, and the stories in the Bible were all false.
Stories.
Yeah, just stories. And that the reality was the scientific truth of the world, and that we were just biochemical organisms who had these short, pathetic little lives, and the point of life was to have as much fun as possible.
And which I guess you were endeavoring to do, huh?
Yes. So I was in San Francisco in the from 67 to 72 in the Bay Area, and that seemed to be like the right place to be at the right time.
Oh, it was.
So I was fairly experienced.
You had a long career in art, didn't you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What sort of you were a professor of art, so you taught art. Well, that's a world away from where you are right now, that's for sure. So something really big obviously occurred to you. When did this happen?
On June 1st, 1985, I was taking a group of students around Europe, and my wife was along, and we had gone all over Germany and Amsterdam and Sweden, and now we're in France, and it was the last day of the trip. And on that Saturday morning, I was in the hotel talking to a student, and I had a acute pain in my stomach, which I found out later was a hole had broken through my small stomach, and the stomach acid and digestive juices was leaking into my abdominal cavity, and felt like I'd been shot. When it happened, I went right down to the ground and just sort of crumpled up in extreme pain and terror. And I thought that I should see glass breaking from the window, because I thought that was the only place that a shot could have come from. It was from outside.
You really thought you were shot?
Yeah, and I just had the most intense pain in the center of my abdomen. I didn't know what was happening, and I was screaming and yelling, and my wife called the desk at the hotel, and they called an emergency service, and a doctor came right away to the hotel room and examined me and told me what the problem was, and he called an ambulance, and...
He was able to figure that out right on the spot, huh?
Yeah, it was very evident to him. And they put me in an ambulance and took me probably 8 miles or so across Paris to an emergency hospital.
Right.
Where I was taken into, examined by two doctors in the emergency room and x-rayed. And the situation was explained to me that this was a fairly grave situation, and that if they attended to it right away, if I had surgery immediately, that I would be in the hospital for 3 or 4 weeks, and I would have maybe 4 weeks of recovery, and I'd be all better. And if we didn't do the surgery right away, I would die very soon.
Wow.
So this was a no-brainer, you know, like, okay, let's do the surgery.
Sure.
So they took me from that hospital, which was a public hospital, to a few blocks away to another building, which was a surgical hospital, and put me in a room on the third floor of that building to have the surgery, as they had told me, immediately. And they kept saying, you know, now, immediately.
Urgent. Right. Yeah.
And unbeknownst to my wife or I, there wasn't a surgeon in that hospital available to do the surgery. We didn't know that, so I was parked.
Very disappointing after they've used all those urgent words.
Yeah, and the pain, which had taken me to the ground screaming, was just gradually getting worse and worse and worse. So it was all I could do to keep my sanity.
I don't know what happens when your stomach acids begin to go into the rest of your body, but it must be horrible.
Well, it feels like having a red-hot coal in the middle of you.
Sure.
And then as it progressed and moved around my abdominal cavity, instead of being a point, it became an area, and then pretty soon it was like all over the whole abdominal area.
So it was obvious to you physically, just lying there, that it was spreading and getting worse very quickly.
Yeah, and it was so bad that a number of times I told my wife to get me a knife because I was going to cut it out. You know, and I would have cut it. She wouldn't, of course, but I would have done it.
You really would have done it?
Yeah, because it would have been preferable to what I was experiencing. Of course, it would have been a disaster if I'd done that, but it would have been preferable to what I was experiencing.
So, still no doctor, and you're just laying there.
Yeah, and people who are so used to American medicine find this part of the story incredible, but unfortunately, a lot of Americans who've had health care in other countries have a whole new appreciation for how good we have it in this country with American medicine.
But I was, usually.
Yeah, usually. But I was just left alone. I was never examined by a doctor. I had never received any medication or any treatment. Matter of fact, there was, even an idea of how stark it was, there was no pillow on the bed. There was no top sheet.
They weren't even giving you anything for pain?
No. And I've had some people say, well, you must have been on drugs when this happened. The irony was is that the few times that the nurse came into the room or an orderly or something, I begged them for, you know, some
drugs.
Nobody could do anything.
Let's have drugs.
Yeah. There was nobody, no doctor to prescribe it, so none of the nurses or other attendants.
Well, that's right. Without a doctor to order a strong pain reliever, there wouldn't be one. That's right.
Yeah. So minutes turned to hours, and hours went by, and I was getting weaker and weaker. And the doctors in the United States later told me that my life expectancy from the beginning of this incident was about 5 hours.
And, holy smokes.
started at almost exactly 11 o'clock, and by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I was beginning to think I wasn't going to make it.
Well, according to the doctors, you technically shouldn't have at that point. One, two, three,
yeah.
Four. That's 5 hours. That's 5 hours right there.
Yeah. So then by 8:30 that night, I was hanging on to life with, like, my fingernails slipping off the cliff.
There was still no doctor there?
No. And I had never been seen by a doctor. Nobody had taken my attention. Temperature, blood pressure, I mean, zip, nothing.
Oh, my God. What? Okay.
I wouldn't recommend this hospital.
Yeah, obviously not.
I would recommend to avoid this place at all costs, but anyways. So a nurse came into the room at 8:30 and said to me and my wife that she said exactly, we're very sorry, but we're unable to find a doctor, and we'll try and get one tomorrow.
What? Yeah. What? I say again, what? Didn't you consider leaving for calling another hospital or, I don't know what the options would have been. Of course, I couldn't.
Well, earlier in an emergency, I had asked if this was the right place for me to be because I was an American. And they said, well, there is an American hospital in Paris, but there's no time to get you there because you're going to have the surgery right away. Now, at this point, I was way too weak. To even contemplate, you know, doing anything.
All right.
So when the nurse told me that there was no doctor available, I figured it was it. It was over. And there was no point in trying to hang on to life anymore. And the pain was so extreme that all I wanted to do was to be out of it. I mean, I wanted out of the world, out of this life. And I knew that when you died, it was, you know, the lights off, you know, curtain down, it's over, it's finished.
Right.
And that was preferable to hanging on any longer because I'd been struggling for hours to stay alive with all of the strength that was depleting, you know, and all of my will. Just, I didn't have any will to live anymore. So I told my wife, I said, it's time for us to say goodbye. And she got up and hugged me and kissed me, and we told each other how much we loved each other, and we said goodbye to each other. It was very painful, still painful to think about that, and for my wife, too.
Yeah, of course.
And she was crying so hard, she sat back down in the chair, and I was watching her cry her heart out, because here she was watching her husband just
die.
Yeah. Fade away from her before her very eyes, and there wasn't anything she could do about it. And I closed my eyes and hoped to die and no desire to live anymore, and I went unconscious. And I don't know how long I was unconscious, probably a few minutes at the most, when I was conscious again, and I was standing next to the bed, and I felt really good. I was very aware of the situation. I knew that I was very sick, and I needed to have an operation. But and I was aware that I had a stomach problem, but I really didn't have the pain. Instead, I felt very alive.
Now, and you were in what kind of state when you? People frequently have told me stories just like you are telling me now of being outside your body, and or hovering over operating tables. And I'm sure you've heard all the stories.
Yeah.
So I'm always curious, what kind of presence did you have outside your body? I mean, could you see your own hand? Could you see yourself?
Yeah, I felt, not only did I feel real, this is weird, but I felt more real than what would be normal. In other words, the bottoms of my feet were very sensitive to the texture and the temperature of the linoleum floor. I felt so strange that I touched my legs and my head because my whole body was so alive. And I was aware that my eyesight was better than normal.
So all your senses were way up there.
Yeah, it was like everything was on overdrive. And I just thought this was like so bizarre, but I was really happy that I didn't have the pain anymore and that I was alive because I the last thing I remembered was dying. And
well, what about the mental concept, though, of intellectually, of standing there looking at yourself? Now, that's got to have some impact.
That I found that very disturbing. So the only thing that I could think of was that the body in the bed wasn't real. And that I was trying to figure out how this could be, so I decided that what they had done was, while I was unconscious, they had made a wax duplicate of me and put it in the bed. The thing I couldn't explain was why they would do that, because, you know, it would have been quite a bit of work to bring in the people from Madame Tussaud's wax museum and make this wax replica of me.
Sure.
But I was so mad at the hospital that I thought, well, you know, they're just messing with me. They're doing this just to mess with me, you know.
Yep.
But then I couldn't figure out why my wife would participate in this, you know, deception. So I started yelling and screaming at her, you know, what's going on here, using some pretty strong language. And she didn't move, she didn't blink, she didn't respond. And so I became really angry at her because now, in addition to this very disturbing thing in the bed that looked like me, she was pretending that she couldn't see me or hear me. Of course, she wasn't pretending because she, of course, didn't see me or hear me.
Right. Oh, no. And so you were angry, frustrated?
Yeah. And so I had a roommate who was a 68-year-old Frenchman who spoke English and a very nice man. And I turned to him and I was screaming and yelling in his face, what's going on here? You know, why are they doing this? What's that in the bed and stuff like that? And he stared through me, from my point of view, pretending that he couldn't see me or hear me.
Uh-huh.
And, so I was just getting into a rage about, you know, this, and I kept thinking, this whole thing's crazy.
And it had not yet occurred to you that you couldn't be seen?
No, not at all, because I felt so real.
Sure.
And I could touch things and feel things. I was completely
gotcha.
Corporal, whatever. And I heard people outside the room, and they were calling me by name in English, saying, Howard, you've got to come with us now. Hurry up. We've been waiting for you. It's time to go. Let's go. So I went over to the doorway of the room, and there were people out in the hallway.
People?
Yeah. And they were very, there's a small number of them, men and women. And it was very dim out in the hallway. The room was bright and well lit, but the hallway was very gray and indistinct, like a really bad TV picture.
Right.
And I said, are you from the surgeon? I said, I'm really sick. I'm supposed to have surgery. I've been waiting for hours, and, you know, and I need to have this operation. And has the doctor come to the hospital? And I said, hurry up. We've been waiting a long time for you. We've got to go now. Let's go.
Did you recognize these people at all?
No. They're very indistinct.
You say indistinct. That's interesting. You mean indistinct in form?
Yeah. Yeah, shadowy.
Shadowy.
Uh-huh.
Very interesting way to put it. Reverend, hold on. We'll be right back. There is a journey that lies directly ahead. My guest is the Reverend Howard Storm. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from May 3rd, 2001.
Never meaning to send beauty I'd always miss with these eyes before. Just what the truth is, I can't say anymore, 'cause I love you.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from May 3rd, 2001.
My guest is Reverend Howard Storm, and we're actually at the very beginning of a journey to hell, if you think you can handle it. Fascinating stuff. We'll get right back to it.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from May 3rd, 2001.
All right, once again, Reverend Storm. Welcome back, Reverend. I do have, if I can ask one question before we continue, just because I know where we're going. You were an atheist, and you were doing what I suppose a lot of people do at that age. But because of where we're going here, I mean, were you a really bad person? I don't know how we're going to define bad here, but I mean, were you a terrible sinner? Were you really out there, an awful person, or just sort of an average person?
No, I thought of myself as a good person.
As a good person.
And I think a lot of people, some people thought I was a nice guy, and some people thought I was a jerk, but...
No, like life.
Yeah, it was... I didn't break the law.
Yeah, you weren't abducting people, you weren't doing bad crimes or anything like that, just sort of an average guy.
No, and I was doing what I assumed everybody in our culture was doing, which was trying to have a good life. I had my friends, and we, drank and laughed and told jokes, and
right.
I had a job, and I worked hard and had a family and was providing for them, so I thought I was doing real well.
Gotcha. Okay. Back to the hospital room, and now you're outside the hospital room. You're in the corridor, and there are what you described almost as shadow beings, indistinct beings beckoning you to come forward or come with them.
Right. And we start walking down the hall of the hospital, and at some point I became aware that the hallway of the hospital was kind of endless, and there weren't any walls or ceiling or lights or anything. It was just... We're moving through a space now without any distinction at all. It's just endless space, and we're walking. If I were to try and duplicate this part of the journey, I would have to walk maybe 100 miles or something.
Wow.
It just went on and on and on and on for what seemed like not just hours, but days or weeks.
Do you remember during that time considering whether you were, were you intellectualizing at all? Thinking, where am I going? Who are these people? Why am I doing this? Is this such a smart idea? Were you doing any of that sort of thinking? Or
yeah, and at first, my assumption was that these were people from the hospital who were taking me to surgery.
Right.
And then after a while, it was like, this is not working out. This is definitely not the way to surgery, and I don't think this is even the hospital.
Right.
I don't know what this is. And then I would start to ask them questions, and they would send me, "Shut up! You know, don't ask questions. You don't need to. You know, you don't need to know anything." And then, from that to, they started talking about me. It was like, he thinks he's so great. You know, who does he think he is, and stuff like that. And then I would hear people say, "Shh, don't scare him. Don't scare him off."
Oh, really?
And so, of course, I'm going from very worried to extremely paranoid,
Yes.
What is going on here? And it's getting, as we're walking along, it's getting darker and darker, and pretty soon it's just abject darkness. And there are now a lot of people around me. At first there was a few, now there's a big crowd in this darkness, and I'm terrified. And I said, "I'm not going any further." And they said, "You're almost there," and they started to push and pull at me to take me further into this darkness, and I tried to fight back with them, and I felt very capable, I felt very strong, I felt very alive, and I was punching and kicking and hitting.
It was real physical battle.
Yeah, and there was this mob of people all around me, and if they had wanted to annihilate me, they could have just done it, and it would have been over with, but instead they were toying with me, playing with me, tormenting me, and every once in a while someone would, like, get a piece of my ear and just rip it off, or, you know, someone's finger would be in my eye, and someone would be gnawing on my Achilles tendon, and, you know, I'm trying to hit back and fight back, and it was ultimately hopeless because there were so many of them and one of me, and around all this was this level of noise of their laughter and their insults and their delight at my struggle. And sort of the more I struggled, the more it gave them, well, I hesitate to call pleasure, but gave them enjoyment out of my pain.
Uh-huh.
And this just went on. People asked me what it felt like, and I sort of felt like what you think it would feel like. It just being beaten and ripped and bitten and clawed and scratched and pushed. And
was there at this point absolute darkness? Could you make these beings out at all in this just, physical fight?
Just complete darkness. They just felt like people. And what I remember from that is teeth and nails.
Yeah.
And then in the midst of this, they were doing worse things to me, things to humiliate me and tear me down, not just physically, but psychologically. And I don't go there. I mean, I don't talk about that stuff.
Why not?
It's too painful.
Was it personal stuff?
Yeah. Too personal.
I only in this area have movies as a reference, and a very great man that I interviewed named Father Malachi Martin, who's now passed away. He was an exorcist, a Catholic priest.
Uh-huh.
And he said that frequently during an exorcism, the kind of personal psychological battle that you're talking about would occur. Very, very personal. You know, hitting all the hottest buttons that you could possibly hit.
Yeah.
That kind of thing, then.
Uh-huh. Yep. And eventually, I was just so broken physically and emotionally that I was in trying to make myself as small as possible, sort of trying to form a ball on the ground of that place, and people were kicking me, and I was so weakened by all of this and exhausted by all of this that I could barely even moan. And I heard my voice, but I didn't say it, and I don't know how this happened, but I heard what sounded like my voice say, "Pray to God." And I thought to myself, what a stupid idea, I don't believe in God. And, in fact, I had probably said my last prayer when I was a teenager. And this was more than 20 years later. So that just wasn't part of who I was or what I did. And then a second time, the same thing, I heard a voice, my voice, say, "Pray to God." And I thought, I don't even know how to pray. I don't know how to ask for help. And part of the person that I was someone who never asked anybody for help. You know, I was an independent, self-sufficient guy who
mm-hmm.
didn't need people.
Mm-hmm.
And a third time, I prayed to God, and I was thinking, what did I say when I was a kid? And I got all confused because I thought that to pray was to recite some memorized verses. That's what I'd done as a child, and I was trying to remember what that was. And
right.
Without intending it.
Something official.
Yeah, right. Without intending it, I kind of murmured some things, and what it was sort of coming out like was, glory, glory, hallelujah, his truth goes marching on, I pledge allegiance to
the goal got Father, mixed up, huh?
What?
All got mixed up.
Yeah, our father who are in heaven. So, you know, just, but when I mentioned anything that had to do with God, the people that were around me became inflamed, and they were screaming at me in extremely vulgar, obscene terms that there was no God, nobody could hear me, and they were going to really hurt me now.
Oh.
What encouraged me to try and remember some phrases that had God in it was the fact that they hated it so much I was finally able to get back at them. And then I noticed that any mention of God actually pushed them away from me and drove them back into that darkness. So I was trying to remember stuff, and it was just all mixed up. And
so at this point, is cause and effect? In other words, you suddenly discovered you had some little weapon or some way to fight back.
Yeah, it had this. What didn't have anything to do with faith or anything. It was just like, this works.
Right.
I'm going with it.
Right. Oh yeah, whatever works in a situation like that.
Yeah. And so I'm trying to remember things that have God in them, and they're screaming and yelling at me and backing up and backing up further and further in the darkness. And then I realized that the only thing I could hear anymore was me. And I stopped, and I listened, and there was just silence around me. So I began to consider my situation, and I can't. I'm too broken and ripped up to crawl. And if I could crawl, where would I go? Because absolutely no sense of how I'd gotten there or where I was, just darkness. And I'm all alone in this place, and so I'm starting to think about my situation and what... since I didn't have any religious background at that time, what I thought had happened to me was that somehow I had gone down the sewer pipe of the universe into the cesspool, and this is where the human garbage goes.
Could you walk around? You were in utter darkness. Could you? I think a natural thing for a human would be to try and define the boundaries of where they were. If you really thought you were alone, you'd try to sort of walk up and...
I couldn't get up. I couldn't even crawl.
So you were in the fetal position.
Yeah.
All right.
And I was all broken and torn. And I thought about my life. And it all seemed so sad because I had wanted to be this great artist, and instead I'd been a mediocre artist at a little, you know, nothing university in the Midwest, and I wasn't a big shot. And I thought about... how I'd failed as a father and as a husband and as a son to my parents. And when I thought over my life, it all seemed so pitiful and stupid and such a waste. And it was like, and I lived all that to end up here.
Hmm.
What, you know, what a stupid, sorry, pathetic little life I had.
Yeah, the trouble is you're describing a great number of us out here.
Yeah. And it just seems so pointless and empty and worthless. And I also was thinking about the situation that I was in, and that there was no way out of it for me, except that I knew that those people were going to come back. And I really didn't want to be the victim of their sadism anymore. And so I thought if there was some way that I could get up my strength, if they came back, I would be as vicious and as cruel
as they were.
As they were, and instead of being the victim, I would become a victimizer.
Uh-huh.
In other words, I would become one of them. You know, hey, if you can't fight it, join it.
Yeah, let's find somebody else and kick them around.
And that wasn't very pleasing to me either, because I really didn't want to be part of their world and their life, which was just sort of gnawing. You know, and seeking sensation.
May I ask another question?
Yeah.
If you found yourself in this situation, one obvious conclusion you would come to is that you were dead. Or that, I mean, obviously you're no longer in the world that you had known.
Yeah.
So you would have to at least intellectually consider the fact that you had died. Did that ever occur to you in the whole time?
Well, the thing that was strange was since I didn't believe that there was life after death, I knew that I was alive, but I knew that I wasn't in the world. And so I thought it was like somehow I had left the world and I would never be a part of the world again. One of the most painful things in this whole experience was the realization I was never going to see my wife, my kids, my parents, my dog.
But that's another way of saying that you realize that you were off Earth and, you know, short of a shuttle trip or whatever.
Yeah.
There's no other way to get off Earth alive anyway.
Yeah. So, but the word dead didn't really occur to me because I was alive.
Because you felt so alive, because you had such a physical presence and you could feel all these injuries.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. Okay, that makes sense.
And the saddest conclusion of all that I came to was that somehow I belonged in this place. That I hated the place and I didn't want to be there, but I knew that I had a certain kind of affinity for the people who had attacked me, and my sense was that they were people who had lived life like I had lived it. Basically, people who had lived for their own gratification.
Uh-huh.
And now I was with them, except that there was nothing good anymore, just emptiness and darkness and hopelessness. So the only gratification left was just sort of chewing on each other.
Brother.
And my sense was that not only would this go on forever and ever, but that it was going to get worse. I didn't know how it would be worse, but...
chewing on each other, that's almost a metaphor for what a lot of people do in life, chew on each other.
Yeah.
But, you know, is that really in your case, it's a ticket to hell, but it doesn't seem like it's deserved. I certainly don't know God as you know God, Reverend, but it seems to me that a man who supported his family and was basically good, maybe took a drink, did a little running around, I mean, that just doesn't seem like it ought to get you a ticket down there.
Well, what I learned later in this experience was is that if we have love in us, and I'm not just talking about self-love, but love for real love for other people,
right,
and give ourselves to other people, that draws us to God. But if the only thing we care about is ourselves...
But you were a family man. You loved your wife, I presume. Your children.
Yeah, but...
You said you missed them.
Yeah, but the sad thing is, and I'm ashamed of this, and I'm not proud of it, is that like I thought of my wife and my kids as like extensions of my ego. You know, my kids were beautifully behaved in public, like in restaurants.
Right.
Because I didn't want them to make me look bad. You know what I mean? And so
sure.
when my kids did well, it was because they made me look good. And I was glad for that. And if they got out of line, you know, I came down on it really hard.
So you're saying it was you were leading an egocentric life.
Right. Right. A totally self-centered.
Huh.
You know, everything was about me. And what I'd learned, you know, as an artist was I thought that was the way to be. That's, you know, all the great artists are big egomaniacs, you know. Nobody ever heard of an artist that, you know, cared about anything but...
You know, sometimes half kind of crazed.
Yeah.
That's so, the life they lead, so, yes.
And so I just thought that was, you know, growing up, I more and more sort of bought into that idea of, like, you know, the world revolves around me and I'm the measure of everything, you know. If you get in my way, I go over you, you know.
Yes, I'm familiar with the philosophy, believe me.
Yeah.
I for example, I have the philosophy that I live and let live. I really feel that, and I don't ever go intentionally after other people. But if they come after me, I have no hesitation whatsoever in taking the war to them, if you follow me.
Uh-huh.
And I guess you do, because that's the way you were, too.
Yeah. But there's a whole other world out there where that type of person goes, but all the good things that we enjoy in this world aren't there. Because I didn't realize it, but they're all gifts.
Huh. All right, we are at a break point, Reverend, and it's just as well, because I need a break for a second listening to this. And I suspect a lot of people out there do, too. As you reflect on what he just said about who he was and who we all are. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from May 3rd, 2001.
Sports.org.
Listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from May 3rd, 2001.
The Reverend Howard Storm is my guest. Have you ever heard anything like this before? I think not. We'll get right back to him.
Now we take you back to the night of May 3rd, 2001 on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Once again, back to the Reverend Howard Storm. Reverend, welcome back. Okay, so here you are, all curled up like a ball in the middle of nothingness, that you hadn't quite, you certainly had not computed in your head yet was hell. Or maybe it wasn't hell. Yet.
I think there's a lot of levels to hell. I think there's a, you know, almost unlimited variety of hellish experiences that people might have when they die, and this was just my hell.
Yours. Uh-huh. Yeah. Bad enough for me. Thank you. Yeah. Anyway, please continue.
And this is really hard to explain or understand, but I feel like I was there for an eternity. I don't know how long I was in that situation all alone, thinking about my life, but there was no sense of any limit to it. It just seemed like an extremely long time without any measure whatsoever. And feeling so sorry for myself and hopeless and desperately trying to find a way out of it, and there was no way out, I recalled in my memory myself as a child in a Sunday school classroom singing Jesus Loves Me. And I felt what I had felt as a child, this sense that there was something very good and beautiful, powerful out there in the world somewhere that cared about me. And I very much wanted something above and beyond myself to care about me. So not knowing if this was just a childhood fantasy or not, I yelled out into the darkness, "Jesus, please save me," with no I had no sense of whether anyone would hear that or if there was such a thing or person or at all, just in the desperate hope that that might be true. And when I did that, a tiny little, what appeared to be a star, began to shine in that darkness and very rapidly got bigger and brighter and came to me. And as its illumination shined on me, I could see that I looked like roadkill. Just gore and ripped and filth. And I felt hands come out of this light and touch me, and all of the wounds and the filth on me just began to disappear. And more importantly, inside of me, all of the pain, all of the despair went away, and I was filled with ecstasy that I can't begin to describe.
Mm-hmm.
And the hands reached under me and picked me up, and I was embraced in this impossibly brilliant white light by what felt like a person, and he was stroking my back very gently, like a mother or a father would with a child. And I began to cry, and that was significant for me because in my adult life, I'd only cried like maybe two or three times because I, you know, grew up in a generation where real men don't cry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was sort of crying all the tears that I had held in all of my life. And we began to rise up out of that darkness. And I think we were going faster and faster. And I was trying to get my composure together enough to, I was trying to stop crying enough to see where we were going, and I looked out and I saw that way off in the distance there was a focal point or concentration of more light, and we were moving towards that, and there was all this activity around it coming and going, and we were moving towards that, and as we moved towards it, I suddenly had the realization that that was like God or heaven or something. And I felt, and I thought to myself, I'm such a piece of garbage. They've made a terrible mistake. I don't belong here. And with that, we stopped. And for the first time, this person, whom I refer to as Jesus, spoke to me. And he said, we don't make mistakes, you do belong here. And then we began to converse, and I immediately realized that he could hear everything that I thought. And then he would project his voice into my head. And I wasn't hearing him through my ears, I was just hearing him speak into my mind.
Right.
And he was trying to put me at ease, and he said he had friends that he wanted me to meet, so he called out with musical tones and about seven people or beings of light, these brilliant white light people came and were hanging in space, and they hovered or hung around us, and then they tried to put me at ease, and one of the things they said to me was, do you want to see us in our human form? And I said, I hate people. When I say I said, I actually never said anything. I just, what I thought. I thought, I hate people. I never want to see people again. And I said, why would I want to see people?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're like so much more beautiful than people. I mean, like, you know, and they said, that's okay. No, whatever. You know, fine. And after, one of the funny things that happened was I realized that at this point I wasn't wearing any clothes.
Oh.
And I was trying to cover myself with my hands. And they were amused at that. And they said, don't worry about it. We've seen it before. It's no big deal. You know? You can relax, you know. And they said that they wanted to show me my life. And so that was fun because, hey, it's going to be about me, you know, like, this is great, you know. I'm getting all this attention, you know.
Yes.
And so we started off and we were watching little scenes And these were sort of like they were projecting from their memory or record of my life, these scenes of my life, starting off as a baby. And, you know, I see my mother and father playing with me, and it just was like to see my parents young and happy, you know, and playing with me as a baby was just so beautiful. And I saw myself growing up and swimming at the beach and, you know, I'm playing ball, you know, out
yes.
the street in the neighborhood,
sure.
and everything's like delightful and wonderful. And then I see, as my life's going on, things beginning to sort of deteriorate, you know, and there's family fights, and I'm sort of hiding in my room because I don't want to get, you know, clobbered, you know, because of what's going on in the household. And
yes.
pulling back emotionally from my family and the world as a sort of defense mechanism, and then moving along. I'm skipping over. I'm not going to tell you the whole story of my life, but as I see, God gives me the gift of a woman who falls in love with me, who I fall in love with, and I was more interested in the lust part than the love part, and we got married, and we had children, and I see myself just pulling back from people emotionally. I don't want to be involved with people, because you're involved with people, you're going to have pain. You're going to get hurt,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yes.
And so I'm becoming more and more hard-hearted and manipulative of other people,
mm-hmm.
where basically, like, everybody else are like chess pieces that I have to kind of maneuver around or through to
yes.
make my way.
Yes.
But I'm not interested in their feelings, you know. I'm not interested in them as people. They're just things that you have to deal with all the time, you know. And some of them are pleasurable things to deal with, and some of them are very disagreeable. And so I just try and adopt this persona of being the biggest, baddest bear in the woods, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That way I will get my way, you know, being kind of like a little mini tyrant in my little world. And it's very painful to see all this in this company, because they were sharing with me their feelings of extreme disappointment, because what they were interested in as we watched my life was where I had been kind, loving, compassionate. One of the scenes that...
So you felt their disappointment, not judgment, or were you feeling judgment, or were you judging yourself?
More of me judging myself, because they were sharing with me that I was completely failing what I had been created for and what they had expected of me.
Well, that doesn't sound so good.
You know, like, for example, my father and I, as I became an adult, our relationship went from bad to worse, to the point where we no longer even had a relationship. And I'd always thought all my life that my father had been a big jerk and I'd been the victim of a really lousy father. But what I saw in this whole experience was is that I had contributed to the failure in our relationship.
Sure.
I had gone out of my way to antagonize him and to be unsympathetic to him, you know. So I had to take some responsibility for the failure of that relationship.
But see, you're not describing anything so bad at all that almost everybody can't in some way or another identify with what you're saying right now with respect to their life.
Yeah, and I think by the standards of our culture, what we call good isn't good enough. It's not what we were created for and what God expects of us. God expects a whole lot more than what we're giving back to God. And I, at several points I said, okay, that's enough. I don't want to see any more of this. Like, you know, I get it, you know.
Yeah.
I said, no, you got to watch this. And one of the things that happened that was funny was every time we'd go close to a period in my life where I had won a prize or an honor or a promotion, you know, or some kind of
something
achievement.
Good. Yes.
They would like skip it. I'd say, hey, wait a minute, you just missed, you know, you just skipped over something. This was like really big, you know.
And plus point over there and going right past it.
Yeah, and they'd say, no, that was nothing. Watch this. and they'd show a scene of me blowing off a student who had come to see me, you know, for some sympathetic advice, and I was just like, you know, I'm thinking in my head while the student's like whining on about their, you know, sad little love life, I'm thinking, oh man, you know, they don't pay me enough to listen to this garbage all day long, you know.
Yes, I'm with you.
And what they had hoped I would have done was to have cared about that person, you know, given them a little time and attention. Not
yes.
that my job wasn't to fix them, but to simply, you know, be there for them, to care about them, be compassionate. So
right.
it was my life review as it progressed was increasingly a disaster. And I'm like really embarrassed and ashamed. And the only good part of it was is that I knew that the company that I was in, Jesus and the angels, were that they loved me in spite of the fact that they knew everything about me. They knew all my dirty little secrets and all
right.
of the rotten things I've done in the world, and they still loved me, although they, I can really say that they hated things that I did. They still loved me as a person, just as I love my kids, no matter what they do, you know, even if they make me really angry or displeased with them, I still love them.
Right.
And I knew that I was loved, even though...
In that same sense.
Yeah.
Yes.
So when it was over, I was, like, really relieved. And it was like, boy, I never want to do that again. Whatever you do, don't show me my life. You
know? I'm not looking forward to it myself.
Yeah.
I mean, there are things that I know that I'm not going to want to review.
Yeah. And they said, do you have any questions? And I went, like, questions?
I got
about a million questions. And they said, go ahead. Ask anything you want. So I had the most wonderful experience of asking questions, and they would answer everything I asked, and they were very kind teachers, because the things that I asked, they would try and explain it in a way that I could understand. And of course,
the audience is obviously going to want to know what you did ask and what kind of responses you got. Anything that we should know?
Well, I mean, there's such a range of things. I could just, you know, go on for days about this, but I could give you a sample of some.
Please, like, do, yes.
In terms of, like, a personal question, I said, why did God make me a person who was never satisfied with, like, what I was told? I was always, like, trying to find out more and more and more, you know.
Good question.
You know, why did God make me a person who just wondered about everything all the time and was never, never seemed to be able to just
yes.
accept things, like other people could just accept it. I couldn't accept it.
Right. Really and, good question.
And they said that that was a really special gift from God. The only problem was is that I had misused the gift, because the purpose of having that kind of a mind was to be able to discover the truth. And they said whenever I found the truth, I would just like, well, that's not it, and I'd keep going. You know, so instead of seeking the truth and finding the truth, I would I turned seeking into its own end. And I was just always questioning and never
mm-hmm.
Receiving the answer, even when it was given to me.
Right.
You know, so it was like nothing ever satisfied me or made me happy. And it was like, my wife loves me. Does she really love me? I don't know if she loves me. Why does she love me? Why would she love me? You know, I mean, it's like, she doesn't love me. How could she love me? You know, like, you know what I mean?
Sure.
When the fact was, she did love me and had stuck by me for 20 years and is, like, obvious to everybody in the world except to me. You know, that sort of thing. So I asked them, this was in 1985, and one of the things that I'd grown up with was the very real possibility of a nuclear war that would annihilate the whole planet.
Yes.
And so I said, is there going to be a nuclear war? And they said, absolutely not. And I said, well, why not? And they said, God's not going to allow it. And I said to them, I said, you guys don't get it. There's like 40,000 nuclear weapons.
You really you said that to them?
Yeah. Well, I was really comfortable with it. I mean, these people were good. You know, these are really...
Uh-huh.
And I said, there's 40,000 weapons poised and ready to go. And even if no one actually plan a nuclear war. It's just inevitable that somebody's going to accidentally set something off, and then there's going to be a nuclear sense, and the whole Earth's going to be an island. I said, it's not going to happen. God's not going to allow it. I said, so is God going to take God's hand and just, like, stop the missiles when they're launched? And I said, if that's what it's going to take, God will do it. And they said, the planet doesn't belong to people. I said, the planet and all that's in it belongs to God, and God cares about all the creatures in the world, not just people, and God's not going to allow human beings to destroy the Earth. And it's like, oh, okay, you know.
Good answer again, if true. Reverend, hold on, we're at the bottom of the hour. Oh, this is really getting good. So he actually had the opportunity to ask questions, and one of them was about nuclear war. We will continue with all of this in a moment. My guest is the Reverend Howard Storm. He's in Kentucky right now and has a church in Norwood, Ohio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from May 3rd, 2001.
And then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again, or to fly to the sun without burning a wing, to lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing, to have all these things in our memories hoard, and to use them to help us.
Radio Networks presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired May 3rd, 2001.
Really interesting watching the reactions on the Fast Blast to the Reverend Storm. There's every range you can imagine, from thank you to I've always wondered to it worries me to boy, am I angry, this is just a religious advertisement, to you name it, the entire range of spectrum of reaction you might get to a story like this. And I've never had one told on the story on the air like this. No story like this, certainly. And so it's kind of interesting to observe the reaction out there. It ranges from joy to, I guess, passionate interest to anger. He's written a book called My Descent into Death and the Message of Love Which Brought Me Back. And I just went myself to Amazon.com, and it received a 5-star review. You know, they take an average of all the customer reviews who have read the book, and it's got a full 5-star review on Amazon.com. Anyway, that is the title of his book, He Wouldn't Tell You, I Will, My Descent into Death and the Message of Love, which brought me back. Check it out yourself on Amazon. We'll be right back.
Now we take you back to the night of May 3rd, 2001, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Somebody comments he's giving us a lot more detail than he was able to do on Oprah. He was on Oprah, I guess, and of course he is. This is radio, not television. You're able to get into a lot more detail. Reverend, welcome back. So you were allowed to ask questions. That has got to be one of the most unusual opportunities a human has ever had. Nuclear war would not be allowed. Anything else?
Let's see. Like I said, that's just, I think I asked thousands of questions. I asked them, what's going to happen to the United States? And they said that this country had been given more than any other nation in the history of the world, and that this was a gift from God, and that God expected us to do a lot with this gift, and we were not doing it. And God was very displeased with America, and that what God was expecting America to do was to be the moral leader of the world, a place where educators, engineers, scientists, teachers would stream out of this country and bring the rest of the world up to the kind of standards that we enjoy, and instead we were more or less exploiting the rest of the world for our own.
Gee, the last time God got disappointed in a specific area, there was Pompeii.
Yeah, and so I said, what's going to happen? They said, unless America changes its ways, America is going to lose all that it's been given. And I said, well, how? And they said, economically, that our economic system would fail and we would sink into chaos, and that the rest of the world would turn their backs on us, because although we are greatly admired by the rest of the world for our prosperity and our wealth, that we're deeply resented because the rest of the world knows that we are basically taking advantage of our position of power in this world. Hmm. And that God wants the United States to be a force for good in the world instead of just...
So your individual ego was demonstrated to you, really, that was sort of answering that the national ego is as much a problem.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Right. And I asked some questions about religion. Like, for example, I said, which is the best religion?
Huh.
And I was expecting them to say, you know, Presbyterian or Methodist or Catholic or...
Yes,
something.
Well, I would be interested in the answer.
And the answer was the one that brings you closest to God. That's exactly what they said. And I said, well, which is the one that brings you closest to God then?
Yes.
And they said, it depends on the culture and the tradition that the person was raised in would be the one. And I said, well, are religions all the same then? And they said, no. They said, there's good religions that have good and bad people in them, and there's bad religions with good and bad people in them, and it really doesn't have to do with religion. It's about what a person does with it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have a perfectly awful religion and have a really good person doing good in it, and you can conversely have a really fine religion and people tearing it down.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been my experience since then, that religions are not inherently good or bad. It's what the individual does with it that makes it either worthwhile or a detriment to, you know, human progress in respect to love. I asked them about what happens to people when they die, and they said that when a good person dies, that God sends angels and or emissaries, and the emissaries might be loved ones that have preceded them, like, for example, your grandmother or parent or brother or sister or something.
Right.
To meet that person.
Very common in NDE stories.
Yeah. And that they would then escort
that person towards heaven. And as they progressed towards heaven, people would become transformed, and all of the worries and doubts and places where they were deficient in life would be changed, and they would become, in time, fully loving people, the children of God, and that eventually that they would meet Jesus, and they would, in time, be presented to God. And I said, and if not, and they said, well, you know what happens otherwise. And I said, well, what determines whether a person goes to heaven or not? And they said, well, if a person is loving and has been loving in their life, they will go to God, and if they haven't been loving, they'll go away from God. And that there's not an alternative to those two choices. You're either moving towards God or away from God, and there's nothing in between. And the journey to God doesn't necessarily happen very quickly. In the case of Mother Teresa, she would be on the express route, you know,
yes,
the non-stop train to God.
Yes.
Someone like me, you know, I'd be on the milk train, you know, making all the local stops while I became a better person in the process.
Okay. What an incredible opportunity to be able to ask all of these questions. I don't suppose you posed one about Buddhists and others who have faith but not in the God that you're talking about right now, who had Jesus on earth, you know, and all the rest of that.
No, I didn't. You know, I wish I... Well, I'm going to get to have this experience again sometime,
yeah,
when I leave this world, but...
You may not be able to come back and tell us about it, though.
Right. But at the time, I had no religious background. You know, I'd never read the Bible or anything.
Gotcha.
I didn't go to church, and so...
gotcha.
I didn't ask really good questions. They were real kind of dumb, but that's where I was at that time. Outcome of all this is that I finally said to him, I said, okay, I'm ready to go to heaven. I want to go to heaven. You know, can I go to heaven now?
Enough.
And they said, no.
No.
You're going back to the world.
To the world.
So we had a huge argument. And I was trying to convince them that it was in my best interest that I go to heaven, and they were trying to convince me that that just wasn't going to happen, and that I had to come back to the world. Like, for example, I said to them, if you send me back into the world, I'm going to make lots of mistakes, and then I'll end up right back where I was. And what would be the point of all this if I'm going to go back into the world and be an imperfect human being? I said, if you send me back, am I going to be perfect? And they said, no. And I said, so I'm going to make all these mistakes all over again? And they said, yes, we know you're going to make mistakes. That's the nature of human beings. They make lots of mistakes. And I said, this time, try and learn from your mistakes instead of just repeating them over and over and over again and just keeping doing the
same thing. Yes.
Yeah, they said they can be learning experiences. And you could actually become a better person by learning from your mistakes. And I said, don't worry about my mistakes. That if I took my mistakes to God and confessed my mistakes, that God would forgive me, and that that would be the end of them. They wouldn't be held against me. I said that to them, I said, you can't send me back to the world because the world is a horrible, cruel, ugly place full of evil people, and just, why would you send me back there? And they said, well, there is that element in the world, but the world is also full of beauty and goodness and love and really fine people. And I said, well, that wasn't my experience. And they said, well, that's right, that wasn't your experience, because that's what you are, and on the inside will attract the experience of life around you, so that if you're loving on the inside, you'll attract loving people to you, and if you look for beauty, you'll find beauty, but if you are cruel on the inside, you're going to find cruelty, and if you're looking for ugliness, you'll certainly find ugliness in the world. So everything that I brought up, they defeated my final really big argument was, I said, you can't send me back to the world because I'll die in the world of a broken heart. Because I said to them, nobody's ever known me or loved me or cared about me the way that you do. And I can't live without this. And they said, you know, haven't you learned, they said to me, haven't you learned anything? Don't you know that we've always been with you, that we've always been around you and known you and cared about you, and we always will be with you? And I said, well, I never saw you before. I never talked to you before. I never knew you were there. How will I know you back in the world? Will I be able to see you? Will I be able to talk to you? And they said, no. And I said, well, then when I get back there, how long is it going to be before I think you're not with me and I'll feel alone like I did before?
Mm-hmm.
They said, well, if you pray, sometimes you might just know in your heart that we're with you. And that sometimes, not when you want it, but when we feel like you need it, we'll let you know that we're around. And I said to them, do you promise that? And I said, yes. And I said, each of you promise me that you will be with me and let me know that you're with me. And so they did. And I said, I can go back if you'll be with me forever. And they said, we are. And then I was back.
And when you were back, what was your circumstance?
I was like a fish out of water, gasping for air. And the pain that I had been in earlier was, I was returned right back to that same messed up body. And I was gasping for breath. And immediately, the nurse who'd been in the room a little bit earlier came back into the room and said, a doctor has arrived at the hospital and we're going to take you to surgery. And they evicted my wife from the room and they prepared me for surgery. And as I passed her on the gurney on the way to surgery, I looked at her and I said, you know, everything's going to be good from now on. And she just cried more because she thought, you know, this is like some, you know, brave words. She didn't realize that I really meant that.
Right.
And when I was in the recovery area after the surgery, this was now on Sunday morning, she came and saw me, and she said, Howard, and I said, it's all love. And she said, I love you. And I said, I know you love me, but I said, it's all love. And she said, well, there's people that love you. And I said, I know there's people that love me, but you don't understand. It's about love. That's what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, oh, that's nice, dear. And I said, it's huge. I said, it's bigger than the whole ocean, and you've got to go into the ocean to experience the love. And she said, you need to get some rest, dear. You know, and I realized that this was going to be very difficult trying to explain this to anyone.
Indeed.
And so from that day on, I tried to tell her what had happened to me. And she had a great deal of difficulty at first, for about a year or two, believing me. But now I think she does believe me.
So you proceeded, obviously, to change your life. You became ordained. And I take it by then she knew you were pretty serious.
Yeah, but this was a long process. I mean, I went through a while of being a religious fanatic and managed to drive everybody away from me and off religion. I probably did more damage, you know, during my fanatical period than many people do in a lifetime. You know, trying to convert people, which doesn't work.
Reverend, I'm kind of curious, and I have to ask for the audience, how do you know that all of this wasn't just a tortured dream from somebody who had passed out in a terrible, painful, physical condition? What makes you know that it was real?
Right. Immediately upon gaining consciousness, that was the first thing that I began to think about.
Sure.
And
I knew that one thing, I knew that something had happened to me that was really, really important, and I needed to pay attention to it. But the problem was is that I knew that if I were to accept what I had experienced, I was going to have to totally change my entire life, which I really didn't want to do, because I'd spent 38 years working very hard to create a life, and now it's like it was all in jeopardy. And that seemed like a really bad idea. Why change everything?
Right.
You know? But on the other hand,
unless I'm absolutely sure this was real.
Yeah. You know, but on the other hand, the angels and Jesus did reappear to me after the experience, and they did things that saved my life afterwards, and it became basically impossible for me, because they were intervening in my life in miraculous ways,
to do anything else.
To do anything else, because it's like, you know, I can't deny it.
Well, that would do it, all right. I suppose otherwise you might eventually talk yourself into the fact that it had been just a bad dream of some sort, and revert to the easier way of living here on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But you say they came again.
Yeah.
That would do it. That would do it. And so, in a long process, then you entered the you entered a seminary, I guess.
Well,
right?
First I discovered church and was in church for a while and thought that church was made up of a bunch of fumbling ordinary human beings, but they were pursuing something really worthwhile, and over a period of years decided I really wanted to be a part of that. You know.
And then you wrote a book about it.
Yeah, last year a publisher from England called me out of the clear blue sky and asked me to write a book, so I did. It was kind of fun.
What an incredible story. Absolutely an astounding story. And I've never heard anybody tell one like it. I want to thank you for being here tonight, and I'm probably going to sit and talk to my audience about this now and see what they have to say, but it's a remarkable story. And by the way, again, you know your book got 5 stars at Amazon.com.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that.
Well, I just took a look myself. It's very well reviewed, Reverend. So, listen, thank you for being here tonight. Thank you for telling the story. And as I told you, I'm getting reactions on the computer, wild reactions in every direction. I imagine we're going to get that on the phone, too. So, bless you, and thank you for being here tonight, sir.
Thank you, Arthur. It was a real pleasure talking with you.
Good night. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from May 3rd, 2001.
I stopped an old man along the way, hoping to find some old forgotten words or ancient melodies. Turn to me as if to say, hurry boy, it's waiting there for you.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from May 3rd, 2001.
You know, I just got an email from somebody. Let me roll back here and read it. It says, the Reverend Howard Storm. The bottom line to Storm's mumbo-jumbo is that there's no proof. The scientific method cannot be used on this because there are no facts to it. When proof is shown, then these nuts, he underlines, can put some weight behind their words. That's from Frank. Well, Frank, yes, you're right. There's no proof. And that actually applies to most things that we talk about here. It's simply hoisted up for your consideration. You listen to the man's story, listen to what he has to say, and you can dismiss it. And I can understand that for you, it may be very comfortable and pleasing for you to do so, and I have no problem with you doing that. We just sort of allow these people to have their say. When I find an interesting story, I put it on the air, and you can do with it as you wish. You know, totally dismiss it as mumbo-jumbo, I think your words were. Or you can consider it and sort of put it in a file, a gray area, I think Stanton Friedman would say, gray box. Or you can embrace it, or you can dismiss it. You can do anything you want with it. It's just a story, I thought, told in a very credible way. And that's it. And that's what a lot of things boil down to. There's very little absolute proof for a lot of what we talk about. It will always be so. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art Bell. Thanks
Hi.
For taking my call.
You bet. Where are you?
This is Tawasi. I'm calling from Morrison, Colorado.
Yes, Tawasi.
I'm calling in with a comment and a question.
Okay.
My comment is that the story that Reverend
Storm
told
yes.
was very similar to that story that you replayed of the young lady who had an NDE herself.
Yes, it's as though she got to look into a couple of areas that he might have described.
Right, only he was more like victimized.
That's right.
My question, though, is this. You, I know, have invested in renewable energy, and I was curious, with the scaling back of funding for renewable energy, if you felt like it was a worthwhile investment for yourself, because George W. thinks that oil and nukes will be a better solution for us.
Yeah, well, I don't care what he thinks. I've already made my decision with my money, so...
And you think it's a good decision, then, renewable energy?
Yes. Yes, I think it's a good decision,
you know,
for me personally and for us as a nation.
I'm so glad to hear that, because the public outcry on this has been amazingly small.
I know.
And it's really disturbing to me as a parent, because I have a child that's going to go into in the next however many decades, and she's going to have to breathe this bunk that they're producing with their fossil fuels.
That's right.
Those oil barons are really, I've had it up to here with them, and that's pretty high.
I hear you, sir. I'm with you all the way, and all I can say is I took a lot of money, more than I should have, and just did it. That's all. I don't know. I can't really, except for what I say, perhaps in some small way influence what people think.
Well, I would really appreciate it if you would have a show about alternative energy.
We had one. You missed it.
Oh, was it recently?
Very recently, yes.
Oh, my goodness.
So,
who's the guest?
Harvey Wasserman was the guest.
All right.
From Greenpeace.
Greenpeace.
Yep.
I know there's a magazine out there, Home Power Magazine.
That's right.
And I've heard the editor, the head editor, speak on a number of public radio.
Well, he might programs. Be. I'd be glad to have him on. If somebody wants to put me in touch with him, I'll have him on.
I'll see if I can get you his address.
All right. Thank you. I'm a big advocate. And, all you can do is, if you believe in something strongly enough, you take individual action. You know, and despite what people think, I don't make a great deal of money doing what I'm doing. I have intentionally not sought it out. I've gone for other things, and so I took a substantial amount of money, more than I should have, and more than, no doubt, will be returned to me for a significant amount of time, and did it, because I do believe in it. Solar power and wind power are absolutely real. They're only two alternatives, but they're absolutely real. They work. I've got it here. I know. So I have a sort of a dual-track thought about the whole thing. And one is, I realize that in the short term, we must have oil, we must have coal. We may even be forced to drill in Anwar. A conversion of a nation's energy supply is not going to be an immediate thing. So we've got to continue to have to meet our demands in the short term. What bothers me is that in the long term, we have decided to put our head in the sand. And we've cut the funding for alternative fuel research in half. Now, that's just plain nutsoid, as far as I'm concerned. Absolutely nutty. But it's what's going on. Wildcard line, you're on... Whoops, would have been. Make it the first-time caller line, you're on the air. Hello. Hello?
Yes.
Turn your radio off, please.
Yes. Yes. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes, this is Sam.
Sam?
And I listened to your program, and I think, you know, Reverend was telling the truth, you know.
So do I. But, I mean, that's just, you know, as the caller or as the emailer said, it's a lot of people will do what that emailer did, and they say, baloney, there's no proof, end of story. Well, okay.
I had experience like that also. I had, you know, like PCO2 was my PCO2, you know, I almost died, and PCO2 was high and pH was down and oxygen was low, and I had experience like that, and I had the same experience, and I was told that there will be like a big comet will be coming in year 2004. Around August 2004, there will be a comet coming to the Earth, and it will damage the oil fields, you know. So I agree with you, there should be alternative energy, you know. The comet will be coming to the Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. And,
well, that would cause lots of trouble.
Right, it will be coming right at the Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Iran and Iraq, and... So I really believe that...
That would solve and cause several problems at the same time.
Right. So all the oil field will be gone. So we really need the alternative source of energy.
All right. I appreciate your call, sir. Yes, if a comet were to hit that entire area, wipe it all out, it would at the same time cure some problems but create monstrous problems. 2004. That would be very poor timing. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art.
Hello.
This is Jeff. I'm somewhere near Frankfort, Kentucky right now.
On a cell phone.
On a cell phone, yes. I apologize. I'm a truck driver.
I understand. That's all right. Go ahead.
I know you don't like people asking how you're doing, so I'll just say I hope you're having a good morning.
Thank you.
I haven't caught any of the previous calls, but I have kind of a dream story that does end in that, well, you know how you have the falling dream?
Oh, yes, falling dreams, yes, of course.
Yes, you know, you always wake up right before you hit.
Right.
Well,
you hit. You hit, right?
Yes, uh-huh. Yes. You had a caller say before that he was in, like, third person watching, so just take a gun to his head.
Yes.
Well, this was first person. And not only did I hit, I bounced about 10 feet in the air and landed again. And on the second landing, I finally woke up.
No kidding.
That was an interesting experience.
Oh, that is interesting, yes. You bounced like Wile E. Coyote.
Well, he kind of hit some flattened, but, yeah, I just kind of bounced. I mean, it was as realistic as a day is. You know, long, but whenever I woke up, I was sweating and out of breath and knew for sure that I was dead.
Yeah, I can imagine, sir. Right. I really appreciate the call. Thank you. Bounced. Now, that's the first I've ever heard of that. In every falling dream I've ever had, I've always gone like that and been awake. And, of course, never fell all the way. Just the sensation of the falling was enough to bring me back awake. But there's somebody who hit, not only hit, but bounced. That's definitely a new one. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Art. This is Dave from Las Vegas.
Yes, Dave.
Listen, talking about chemtrails a little bit. I was watching the local news the other day, and you know how they show the state of Nevada and the Doppler radar.
Yes.
And the bottom probably quarter of the state was green, was getting a green radar echo.
Yes.
I looked out the window, and of course the sun shined bright. And the weather forecaster kind of chuckled. She said, well, you know it's not raining outside. She said, that's Nellis Air Force Base.
Doing something.
Chaff.
Chaff, really?
Yeah. Chaff. She said so that they can test their airplanes without anybody else knowing it.
I see.
I thought that was something. I've never heard of that before.
Do you think that was a guess on her part?
Well, I don't know. She sure made it sound official. But I don't know if that's what she was told officially or not. But it was just a bright green, just like it was a thunderstorm.
Well, you gotta say something, right? If it's bright green, that means it should be pouring out there.
Yeah. I had never heard that before, and I asked a friend of mine. They said, well, they used chaff in what, World War II or so?
Well, we still use chaff.
We still do.
We do. Uh-huh. But that's an interesting explanation. What channel was that on?
Channel 8.
Channel 8, huh?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I just thought I'd let you know.
Okay, thank you very much, and take care. Interesting. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from May 3rd, 2001.
All right, back we go to all of you out there. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I'd rather not be on the radio.
Okay, well, then I've got to go. See you later. The only reason you would call here is to be on the air. And if you don't want to be on the air, then I've got to take you off immediately because that's the first line that I say. Hi, you're on the air. So if after that you say, I don't want to be on the air, then actually you're going to immediately be off. A wild card line, you're on the air. Hello.
Let me turn my radio down.
Thank you.
Yes, Art.
Yes.
I've talked to you about six times on the air and off in the last month and a half. And I wanted to point it out. I want to thank you. Earthlink Mindspring gave me the discount that you had over a year ago.
Did they really?
You know why?
Why?
Because they recognize the value of your commercial. So I want to give them one now.
This is
B.O. We'll be listening to KSCO, 1080 AM on the West Coast.
Yes, sir.
And I want you to have this presentation, if you like, Earthlink Mindspring. I've talked to, besides you, several other professional friends in the computer field who say that's the best medium for research as a server, ISP, however you call it. And I now have a permanent account, automatically deducted Visa every month as of the 17th of last month, thanks to you.
Well, thank you very much for the commercial. I've been using them since, about a year and a half, 2 years now? I've been on Mindspring and very satisfied with their service. And they are everything that I advertised them to be when I advertised them. Would love to be advertising them again. I mean, they were absolutely everything that that they were cracked up to be, and I'm still using them. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hello, Art. How are you doing today?
Okay, sir.
This is Ed from Most Like Washington.
Yes, Ed.
Hey, I got a request. Diane Stein.
Who?
My wife has been studying the Reiki arts, and I was wondering.
You're confusing me. I'm sorry. You said Diane Stein?
Yes.
I
thought that you might have had her as a host in the past.
A host?
I mean, a guest in the past. I'm
no,
sorry.
No, not that I'm aware of.
I was just wondering, maybe you might have her as a guest.
Who is she?
She's in the Reiki healing arts.
Okay.
And I was just curious, maybe you might have her in the past.
You get information? No, I haven't had her in the past, as I just told you. You get me information if you would like me to have her on. In fact, I'll say this to all callers now and listeners. If there's somebody that you would like me to have on, if at all possible, don't just say, oh, would you please have on so-and-so. Give me some information so I can contact them. Any contact you have, information you have at all, greatly enhances your chances of my getting that person on. Because there's a great deal involved. In fact, people who would like to be on the air should contact me, artbell@mindspring.com. If you're a guest, a potential guest, or you want to have somebody on, do the best you can to get me some contact info. It will really enhance the possibility of that person getting on. Wildcard Line, you're on the air.
Art.
Yes.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Just two catchwords maybe you really want to call. When your guest earlier said, it's all about love.
Right.
And it's funny, too, these other people. I also, about 3 months ago, died in a dream. I was living as either a Native American or indigenous person. Real simple living, prairie-like, and we were being attacked. And I was killed by a spear through the stomach.
Ouch.
And it was really strange because I went to a remembered place where you go when you die, and I know I'd been there before. And I wanted to go right back, and they were telling me you don't have to go right back, but I do because of the message. And they said, well, you can't bring the message. You have to leave that here. But in my dream, somehow, I brought it, and it was the exact same thing he said. I was telling these people who were being slaughtered by others that don't worry about it. It's no big thing. It's all about loving each other. None of this matters.
Well, I suspect that's absolutely accurate. It probably, in the end, is all about love. I think that's right.
Yeah.
I believe that's correct.
I also wanted to thank you for Father Martin. I never heard his first one with you.
Yes, he was. I'm not the one to thank for Father Martin, believe me.
Well, you got him on the air.
For interviewing him, sure.
But you might want to rethink, in honor of him, the Antichrist line. Because I remember one of his answers was, we all modify each other through any interaction.
Well, I don't know about rethinking the Antichrist line. I think it's healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Very healthy. And you never know, of all the calls you get out there, if just one of them, it only takes one that's real.
This is true. But it's also the same reason we find, our most hilarious jokes are at other people's misfortune, because we have to laugh at that because it may happen to us.
That's right. I guess that's why we laugh. It's like, why do you laugh when somebody, especially a loved one, stubs their toe?
Yeah.
And they're screaming and yelping and jumping around the room.
And you start to clap like the three Stooges for them, and then they really hate you.
Yeah, that's how it goes.
Yeah.
That's right. I'm not sure what that's all about psychologically, but it cannot be helped.
Yeah, well, you have to tell jokes when you're at a funeral or you go nuts. Like at a wake type, when you're sitting around for hours.
Yes, well, I don't personally believe in funerals. My view is that once the person is gone, that's just their body. They're long gone, and you're gonna, if you're gonna make peace with them or help them out, it's gonna be mentally in your own connection with God.
I think so too.
I appreciate the call, sir. Thank you. And for that reason, I avoid funerals. I always have. I think it's a ritual. I understand it, and I understand that it gives some people comfort, but I'm not one of those people. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, this is Whitney from Washington.
Hello, Whitney.
How you doing, Art?
Okay.
Good. Is my radio off?
I hope so.
Good deal. I turned it off. I got the ring, so I turned it right off. Hey, the guy, the caller that was calling in about the, he said he shot himself in the head in his dream?
Yes.
I had one just like that.
You too?
Yes.
And what happened?
That's why I called in. Well, in my dream, it was a little bit simpler. I was dreaming, put the gun up to my, I'm not even sure if I did that, but I got a gun up to my head, shot myself in the head.
Yes.
In my dream, it just went black, and I woke up. But I could feel,
And everything just went black.
Yeah, but I could feel everything about it.
Huh.
So I wanted to call in and let that guy know he's not the only one.
I appreciate the call, sir. And by the way, speaking of guns and bullets, has anybody heard about the new green bullet? It was on CNN headline news all day long today. It's a new green bullet, kinder to the environment. I'll tell you more about it. This is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from May 3rd, 2001. Again.
Listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from May 3rd, 2001.
Good morning from the heart of the new old West. That would be Pahrump, Nevada. That's the place I live in, broadcast from. Glad to have you along. In a moment, we'll be right back.
Now we take you back to the night of May 3rd, 2001. On Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Tonight, Dr. Stephen Greer is going to be here, and Dr. Greer is finally actually doing it. He's talked about it for years and years, and he is going to the National Press Club, and in front of the nation's press, he is going to parade a lot of people that he has been unwilling to talk about for a long time. It's a very, very, very serious affair regarding UFOs, retrieval operations. There are going to be military people talking that have never talked before. Tomorrow night, you're going to get a preview of what's to come. And so if you're part of the nation's press, you probably want to be listening tomorrow night and sort of mentally deciding whether you I want to be at the press club, whether you think it'll be a worthwhile endeavor to be at the press club. It's going to be quite something, and it's been a lot of years in the coming, and I'm sure you've heard Dr. Greer talk about it many times. Well, May 9th, it happens. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Art.
Yes.
This is Steve in West Hills, California, listening to you on KFI.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was just curious on your wind generator.
Yes.
I was watching the world news tonight, and, you know, we were talking about last night about your book and validation about the weird weather.
Yes.
He was using the expression tonight, wild weather.
Who was?
Dan Rather.
Dan Rather was? Wild weather, huh?
So it's they're starting to talk about it in the mainstream media,
yeah,
finally.
Yeah, I know.
But on your wind generator?
Yes.
What kind of winds will that sustain before... you know, if we start getting these really bad winds before it would damage it?
Well, it would probably sustain very severe winds. I have two wind generators on 48-foot masts, and they're guide with aircraft cable, so they're not going anywhere. And the wind generators themselves are meant, when the wind becomes too severe for them, which it does do out here, they automatically tilt backwards so that... The wind can't damage them.
Oh, that's good. I was just thinking...
Do you understand that? In other words, there's a spring arrangement on the entire motor. It's really nothing more than a motor. It's a stator, a generator. And the whole thing tilts backwards. And, of course, as it tilts backwards to protect itself, it stops catching as much of the wind. And in severe enough winds, it'll literally tilt 90 degrees.
I see. I was thinking that the weather might get so bad that things like that might just become useless or just get destroyed, you know, if the wind gets 100 miles an hour.
Well, past some certain point, there are other things to worry about, like your house getting up and leaving.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Yes, that's the answer to your question. They protect themselves.
And I was going to tell you about, you know what you need to do about the mad cow thing?
What?
Need to do what I'm doing. My consumption of beef has about tripled because I want to eat as much of it as I can now before I can't eat it. And I notice the people in the grocery store.
Yes.
If you, I don't know if you do your shopping, but the people at the meat department in the grocery store are getting a little freaky, I think, because they were bumping us out of the way the other day when we were in there. It was a sale on beef, and my girlfriend just hollered at me something about the prices, like, look at these.
Yes.
And there was people, this woman came over and almost grabbed the pot roast that she had right out of her hand, and within 10 seconds there must have been 10 people right in that area trying to clean up what was
Here, the discount beef counter, it's just got little purple spots. Don't let that bother you.
No, this is real good. This is like $12.
I understand.
Marked down to $3-something.
Yep, and I was just kidding with you.
Oh, yeah, well, all right. Grab that and throw that in the freezer.
All right, thank you very much. Discount. More bigger discounts for the yellow spots. I don't know about, you know, just trying to over-beef yourself now in order to prepare for a dearth of beef later. Probably not a real good idea. First-time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Art. I was wondering, have you made a connection, like, with the guest tonight about It's All About Love and then those two gentlemen a few nights ago who were talking about Raw or whatever, but they were saying that the fourth level of being a human was all about love?
Sure. Of course I've made a connection, and there are many people saying exactly the same thing. And you can choose to think that one is valid because it meets your expectations of what spirituality ought to be, and the other is mumbo jumbo. It just, I guess it depends, you know.
Just I was thinking when you had, I think it was Terrence McKenna's brother on, was that the gentleman who passed away and his brother came on?
Yes.
And he was saying that he thought during the hippie era, at the very beginning, we were headed in the right direction, and it got off track, and that was all about love back then.
That's right.
And it was just
echoes, huh?
Everywhere. It all seems to come together in the end, huh?
I couldn't agree more.
All right, I just was wondering.
I wish I could live the standard, but I couldn't agree more. And I think that is ultimately true. It's probably all about love. What else is there? It's all about love. Sure. And so many say it in so many different ways. Some of them, as I said, depending on your belief system, will strike you as mumbo-jumbo. Some will make you angry. Some will make you happy. Some will make you understand. It will just hit you in all kinds of different ways. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Art. This is Maggie's grandfather, Pretty Good Ed, calling from northern Minnesota.
Welcome.
I've never heard you say anything about any metaphysical experiences you yourself have experienced.
Well, then you haven't been listening long enough.
I know I haven't.
No, also, I've had quite a bit to say.
Also, you never mentioned, you did mention about a week ago that you have never piloted a small airplane.
Well, not by myself.
And so I just thought a catalyst I had for metaphysical experience was taking lessons on a small little Cessna airplane.
Yes.
After about 3 hours, when I was capable of doing horizontal figure eights at a 60-degree bank.
Oh.
That night when I was going to sleep, I had memories of astral travel pre-birth, which is very interesting.
Oh, that is interesting. Thank you very much. That is interesting. I've had a yearning to fly all my life, and I have made several attempts. Some of them didn't work out so well, beginning when I was young. I actually jumped off a building with an umbrella a number of times. You would think one time for that would be enough. But I will tell you this, for a young man, it actually is possible that a well-constructed umbrella will, you can actually feel it begin to support your weight for kind of a split second before it turns inside out, and then you fall down like Wile E. Coyote. Boom. But I tried that several times with several grades of umbrellas. It was never a satisfactory experience, and I got hurt. Wildcard line would have been on the air. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, I'd like to know about that John Edwards.
What would you like to know? Turn your radio off, please.
Okay.
What about John Edwards?
My wife, she passed away a year ago in May 25th.
Yes.
It's almost up. And I watched his show a few times.
On the Science Fiction Channel, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. He talks to the people that have passed on.
Yes.
Or they give him messages.
Yes.
And it sounds okay, huh? Have you ever seen the show?
Yes, I've seen it. I'll give you what advice I have, and that is you must use self-discernment. Nobody is going to advise you, least of all me. Am I going to tell you John Edwards is the real thing or not? No, I am not. Nor can I know about anybody else, including the people that come on this program. How can I possibly know and possibly be in a position to advise you on whether it's a real thing? That's something you can only decide for yourself. So I would never, ever endeavor to tell anybody, oh, yes, sir, he's a real one. He's really talking to the people on the other side. I have no idea. Wildcard line, you're on the air.
Hello, Art.
Yes.
I'd like to give your viewers listeners some information about an e-zine that I think might be very interesting to them, considering tonight's topic.
Okay.
It's called The Greenstone Review, and it's basically an e-zine that's about what we're meant to do here on Earth, why we have astral travel experiences, lots of other issues that I think apply to your discussion tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually sent you an email a while ago, and I didn't give you the address that I should have given you. So if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to give the email address for your listeners so that they can subscribe.
No, I can't let you do that, hon. I'm sorry. We have a rule against that.
Oh, I see.
So,
okay.
If you want to send it to me an email, though, you're welcome to send another email.
Okay, that'd be terrific.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We do that. I try to explain this to people whenever it comes up. For obvious reasons, and I know that most of you are absolutely well-intended when it comes to an email address or a web address, but we have been burned a number of times. People giving supposedly benign addresses to hither and yon, and they turn out to bounce into a porno site somewhere, and so we just don't do it. Hope you understand. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes, good evening, Art.
Good evening,
morning.
Sir.
I'd like to make two comments, and then I'll hang up, and I'd like to get your reply about them.
Fire away.
The first one is about the Never a Straight Answer organization. And
what?
I'm
sorry, what is it?
NASA.
No. Yes.
Isn't that for Never a Straight Answer?
Yes.
Yeah. And the man who went up and spent $20 million.
Mr. Tito.
Yes. When I look around me of where I'm living, in the city I'm living, and I see that there are homeless shelters that are closing because they can't raise $150,000 in their elderly places and things that feed the poor, and they're closing because they can't even raise $50,000, $75,000.
Yes.
I think that it's an abomination that a person would be, and I think that it relates to the man's story, which will be the second thing I talk about. It's so self-centered, and it's not going anywhere until people start to put the funding back into society.
Well, then you must then think that the space station itself is an abomination.
Totally,
right? Totally.
Yeah, I think it's.
And you think any probe that we would send to the moon or Mars are abominations?
At this particular point, at the state that the Earth is in and what man has done to natural resources of the Earth, yes, I think we should be focusing right now on cleaning up the environment.
Oh, I do too. But I think we can do both. And I don't think the space station is an abomination. And I don't think that man's quest to keep pushing the envelope is an abomination. I think it's something that together we can and should do. I just think that NASA should be more responsive to those people that support it. Like, you know, us, the taxpayers.
I agree with that, and I do agree that both things could possibly be done, but I don't think man is on the spiritual level, to tell you the truth, to be able to go out into space. Just for the fact that
well,
when I look around me,
that's a different argument.
Things shutting down.
Yeah,
they can't even raise $50,000, and there's people homeless and starving in the street right in front of me.
Uh-huh.
And a man self. This now, I'll make the second point because I don't want to take up all the time. I believe that this man experienced exactly what he experienced. Your guest tonight.
Yes.
I believe that he totally experienced that from his background when he called out. And by the way, I've never once heard someone on the air actually say Christ's actual historical name, which in Hebrew was Yehoshua.
Right.
And,
You know what, though? I don't think it matters.
It does matter.
No, I don't think it matters.
I don't think it matters.
You're right, you won't. I don't think it matters one bit. That's my take on it. You see, I think that if you call out, and you're calling out to God, and you don't have quite the right name, you're going to just sink into the depths of hell because you didn't get the name right. That's just something that I personally don't believe about God. It's part of this strict religious dogma that drives me away from it in the first place. If you are in absolute distress, and you say, oh, God, help me. Please help me. Or Buddha, or whatever it is you believe in, then I rather think that you will be helped. And I think that if you don't get the name quite right, or you don't use the perfect biblical version of the name, that is going to prevent you from getting help. If that's the case, then it's not exactly structured as I imagine anyway, which, of course, it might not be. But if it's like that, I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't buy it. International Line, you're on the air.
Yeah, g'day, Art. It's Andy from Melbourne, Australia here.
Hello, Andy.
I was just switching gears a little bit from the last call, but something that I've come across on the net about the UFO X-Files internet show that was supposed to be held is going to be cancelled. I was wondering if you'd heard any more about that.
I did hear something about a cancellation.
Apparently their site got hacked and they were concerned that they won't be able to really run it. Maybe the Chinese hacked them.
Oh, I was going to say, was it the Chinese, do you know?
Well, if that's the case, then the U.S. hackers weren't good enough to get back at them, huh? But the problem...
We have best hackers in the world. I have confidence in our hackers, and I hope they take after the Chinese and beat their butts.
Well,
I hope they turn their servers into liquid.
Good for you. There you go. But, I was a little bit concerned about some of the people that might have already paid up. And if it is definitely cancelled, apparently they're claiming that the whole thing...
I'm afraid. No, I can't give you the official... That's what I heard, too, that they were hacked. But I only heard it in email, so we ought not say it like it's official until we know.
No worries. Okay, then. I just thought I'd run it past you anyway.
All right. No, thank you very much. No, I heard the same thing. I obviously can't make an official announcement without more knowledge. A wild card line, you're on the air. Hello.
Good morning.
Hi, turn your radio off, please.
I just did.
Thank you. Proceed.
My question for you, Art, is I know you've expressed libertarian views in the past.
Yes.
And my question for you is, if you believe in libertarian views as Harry Brown and so forth, why do you think it's George Bush's why should he fund
an attempt to
alternative energy?
Yes.
Hold on, sir.
Oh, I never said that I believed everything that Harry Brown believes, nor have I ever said that I am a pure libertarian. In fact, I've had this discussion with Harry Brown on a number of occasions when he's been on the program. I think there are certain proper roles for government. A pure libertarian just about thinks there shouldn't be any government at all. That's not me. I'm more of a libertarian than I am anything that would be defined by the other two political parties. But I think that a proper place for government is the health and welfare of the people that it purports to serve. and allowing us to go down a blind alley using fossil fuels until they're gone, or we have a crisis and or a war, is just plain stupid.
Well,
is that clear?
Well, yes, it is. But my opinion is if alternative energy sources are commercially viable, they should be able to stand on their own. The government shouldn't have to subsidize them.
Oh, I don't think I said anything about subsidizing. I think we were discussing funds for research, weren't we?
Well, the two are pretty much tied together in as much as if alternative energy sources are commercially viable,
yes,
then they'll be able to carry themselves on their own. Now, I know you've set up an alternative energy source. You said you have wind source there.
Wind and solar, yes.
They're in Pahrump.
Yes.
But, I live in Southern California, and I've considered that as an option myself, but the return is so small compared to the expenditure that I'd have to put out.
Well, the show is ending. What I would suggest is you call and we'll have a more extensive conversation about this, on another night, okay?
Okay, Art.
Do me a favor, next time call on a real phone.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm a truck driver.
No, I understand. Just pick a real phone and call me, all right?
Okay, I appreciate it.
Good night, my friend, and all. Ta-ta.